Okay.
Yeah.
Hello and welcome to Distant Island on the 20th of February 2009.
We're in Rampart, back in Rampart.
Back in Rampart.
Yay.
Still here.
Can never leave. And for tonight's show, we have a financial meltdown special exploring some of the causes and potential outcomes of the current economic crisis. In tonight's show, we're looking to explore the causes of the meltdown, its social and economic impacts, and spaces opened up for alternatives, if any, in the current climate.
So the show is basically going to be bookended by two pre-recorded interviews that we did before. The first one that you're going to hear is with Nicholas Hilliard from the Corner House, and at the end we have an interview with Simon from the Iskanda Collective.
Yeah, and so the panel discussion is going to be split up into three segments of about 15 minutes each, and between those we'll have some punk tracks.
Short punk tracks.
Yeah. And the Q&A will happen in the last part of the three segments, so we ask you, the audience, to think about questions that you'd like to bring up at the end of the show.
So now we're going to go into the interview with Nicholas Hilliard.
Nicholas Hilliard is a co-founder of The Corner House, a UK research and solidarity group focusing on human rights, the environment, and development. Before forming The Corner House, he was co-editor of an environmental magazine, The Ecologist, from 1976 to 1997. Hilliard was actively involved in the Ilisu Dam campaign. Nicholas is the author of a paper entitled A Crumbling Wall of Money, Financial Bricolage, Derivatives and Power, a very compelling document of some 60 pages which demystifies the credit crunch by making transparent some very complex trading mechanisms and more broadly serves as a critique of neoliberal market practices.
With some colleagues, I went to a meeting in Rome, which was a meeting put on by an industry group about export finance. They were all talking about derivatives, and they were all talking about these state-of-the-art, masters of the universe means of parceling up risk and spreading it around and offsetting risk in such a way that they were talking as if the issue of risk had just completely evaporated. So I started looking into this a bit, and then as we were doing it, I mean, more and more of the groups that we work with in solidarity, the groups I'm working, for example, on mining, were beginning to talk about new actors coming in, new companies and forms of finance coming in to fund very destructive projects, and a lot of these were things called hedge funds. It ended up with the companies having a lot more money to play with, and this wall of money was being created through financial speculation. I mean, what we discovered, I mean, it wasn't just us, but I mean, reading the Financial Times and so on and so forth, you know, you begin to realize there was a whole new world out there, finance, a shadow banking system, completely unregulated, that within about, from the years 2000 to 2007, in 2000, 97% of loans were provided by banks. By 2007, about 50%. The rest were being provided by the shadow banking system. And because it was unregulated, because, you know, it was very opaque, you couldn't track down who the shareholders, a lot of the traditional ways of working on these issues were cut off to activists. So that's why we began to look into it. And, of course, then the credit crunch came and the rest is sort of unfolding history.
So could you tell us about derivatives?
Derivatives are financial instruments whose value is derived from the underlying asset. It isn't the underlying asset itself. So, I mean, to give you an example, if you wanted to make money out of oranges, you know, traditionally you'd make up money by either growing the oranges, selling them, and making some money. Or you might have a shop and you sell the oranges and you make some money. A derivative makes money out of oranges by speculating on the rise or fall of the price. So it's an instrument that allows you to speculate on the orange without owning it. And you can make money whether the price goes up or whether the price goes down. So it doesn't matter whether you're not investing any longer in a company because you think that, you know, long term, its value is going to increase. It's going to increase production. It's going to bring new jobs, blah, blah, blah. And the share value will go up. You can make money if the share value goes down. In fact, you make a lot of money if the share value gets done. So derivatives enable you to make money on the underlying value of an asset. You're speculating on the price. Recently, I mean, what's happened is that companies like mortgage providers, for example, have been making mortgage loans to members of the public. And in order to keep on expanding the market for mortgage loans, they've been taking those loans and they've been packaging them up and they've been selling them to another company, which they set up in normally a tax haven. Once they've set the company up, they sell the package of mortgages to that company. The company then issues a derivative, a bond in this case, that gives the people who buy the bond the right to the income stream on those mortgages. So they don't own the mortgages, they don't actually own the loans, but they have the right to the income stream on it. And that's done through this process of a derivative. And that vehicle is called a special purpose vehicle or a structured investment vehicle.
And those SPVs are oftentimes owned by the entity that set them up in the first place in order to shift the risk elsewhere.
That's right. I mean, if you're a bank, because of new rules that have come in on banking, you've got to keep a certain percentage of your assets against your liabilities. So if you want to reduce your liabilities, what you do is you put them into a special purpose vehicle, and normally they're off your balance sheet. They no longer belong to you, although the vehicle may well belong to you. And one of the reasons for the credit crunch is that, you know, thousands of these special purpose vehicles have been set up. Derivatives have been sold on the income streams from them. No one knows who's got those derivatives. People have then sold other derivatives, which are called credit default swaps, which are unbelievable. I mean, they are basically instruments that allow you to speculate on whether or not that particular vehicle is creditworthy or not. So it's like me taking out a bet on whether your house will burn down. So on top of these special purpose vehicles and the derivatives that they've issued, you've got other derivatives that are betting on whether those derivatives are creditworthy or not. And it's just an endless porridge of different derivatives. And no one knows which ones have value and which ones don't. And that's one of the reasons why banks have been very reluctant to lend to each other, because they've found that they are holding a lot of very bad loans on their books. What's happened, really, is that as the state particularly has withdrawn from public housing and has put the provision of housing more and more over to the private sector, and it's become more and more incumbent on people to actually try and take out a mortgage and buy a house in order to provide for their own old age, because the state's withdrawn from pensions and so on and so forth. So mortgage companies have been selling more and more mortgages. They've taken these mortgages and they package them up. But because they've also been going out there, each time they're packaged up, they get a new tranche of money to go out and try and get people to take mortgages with. They've been going out to people whose income really does not sustain a mortgage. And these are known as subprime, the subprime market. And they were saying, you know, look, package all your debts together, we'll give you a mortgage, you can pay off your debt, and don't worry, because the house price will rise. Mm-hmm. And there was an assumption that prices of houses would go on and go on rising. Now, when you've got a whole mass of some quite good mortgages from people who definitely can pay off, and some people who are much riskier and may well not pay off, who wants to buy the risky ones? So what they did when they packaged them together was they came up with a mechanism known as tranching. Mm-hmm. And what they do is they tranche the loans. That is, they'd slice them up and they'd sell the least risky loans. They'd get a rating agency, which is an agency which looks at the risk of the default. And they were paying the rating agencies, so the rating agencies had a interest in actually coming up with the answer that they wanted. And they would rate the one tranche as AAA rated, very, very secure. Mm-hmm. And they'd sell that off to pension funds and so on. Those pension funds would be the first to get the income stream. They'd get the first bite of the income stream. Then there'll be another tranche called a mezzanine tranche, which would be riskier mortgages. And they'd sell them off to other, investors, but investors prepared to take a bit of a risk. And then the third tranche, which is the really risky mortgages, were sold off to hedge funds and others who were prepared to take a high risk because the income, they got much a higher income than the ones who were taking the lower risk tranches. And then, of course, all of them started selling them on to other people or taking on other derivatives to pass on the risk and so on. The comedian Mark Thomas is doing a show around the financial crisis at the moment. He's got a very nice way of putting it. One of the people who did this process of what's known as securitization, you take your mortgages, you sell them to an SPV, and it's known as securitization, was David Bowie. David Bowie securitized his entire back list of songs, and he made about $50 million. He sold bonds. You could buy Bowie bonds, and with that Bowie bond, you'd get a right to the income from the royalties from the songs. You didn't own the songs. He still owned the songs, but you got the right to the income, and he got $50 million up front. Nice lump sum tranche from doing this. But it's like, you know, you could have bought The Laughing Policeman, or you could have bought Ziggy Stardust, you know, and they're all bundled in together. So all in the same package. And I think that's quite a good way of, it made a lot of sense to me, that.
This unregulated derivatives trading and the emergence of the shadow banking system have recently led to increased demands for regulation. Do you think that any regulation that will emerge can help anything?
It's very interesting that the people that the governments are now looking to come up with new forms of regulation are exactly the people who have got us into the mess in the first place. My own view is that there are very real questions about whether or not you really can regulate it to any degree that would be, really reduce the risk. They're talking about making it more transparent. They're talking about making the amount of money that banks have to keep on their balance sheet much against liabilities higher. These are all things that are useful, but in my view, they're not really going to address the issue, because the issue is that these are speculative tools and they are gambling. And if you were to regulate them as gambling, they actually would be far better regulated than if you were regulating them as financial instruments. So I think that there's a regulation certainly necessary, but it isn't going to reduce the risk. And actually, there are deeper structural causes for the crisis that which have to do with what the economists call financialization, that are really do need to be addressed and which require real change in the way we live and the way we organize ourselves as a society. The state, under the influence of free market policies, which, you know, both Labour and Conservative have bought into to one degree or another, has shed its responsibilities for whole areas of social provision that it used to be responsible for. It used to be responsible for pensions, it used to be responsible for education, for healthcare, and so on and so forth. More and more of those services, people are now being expected to pay for themselves. There is only a limit to which the private sector can actually fund that without going to financial markets, without having to recycle the money the whole time. And that's what securitization is basically about. You're selling, packaging your loans, you sell, you get a lump sum from selling the derivatives on them. You can then use that lump sum to lend more to further mortgage, for further mortgages, or for building more private sector healthcare homes and so on and so forth. So the withdrawal of the state from whole areas of public service, and the decollectivization of society, if you like, is a fundamental reason for the crisis. And financialization just means that more and more of our interactions with services and with markets is via the financial market. You know, you want a loan, you go to you want to be a student, you go to the bank. You get the money from the bank raises the money on the financial markets. So it's this use of financial markets the whole time. And that has real implications for also for companies. I mean, in order to be able to survive and keep up the share prices, they've got to constantly be looking at the short-term values that are put on their shares within the financial markets. So I would argue that if you're looking at the crisis and the causes of the crisis, I mean, sure, you know, bonuses, approximate cause, and the lack of regulation is only approximate cause. Actually, what really is fundamental is that the withdrawal of the state from whole sectors of provision. And I think that raises questions for all of us, you know, like if the state is to come back in, I mean, if it nationalisation of the banks and so on what conditions should be set with that nationalisation? What sort of state does one want? Is it the old-fashioned state of the 70s, which is very top-down, very bureaucratic, or is one looking for a new relationship between the public and the citizen? Who defines the public interest? Whose voice counts in all of that? Mm-hmm. These are really fundamental issues that actually lie at the heart of the financial crisis. They're questions that lie at the heart of any discussion of democracy, and in this case, of democratizing markets.
Thanks to Nick for that. If you're interested in reading his paper, you can find it and many other interesting ones at www.thecornerhouse.org.uk. And now we're going to go into the panel discussion, and we're going to start by introducing our panelists. First on the list, by alphabetical order, is Bill. So could you tell us about yourself, what perspective you're coming from?
I have been a union activist for a very long time, around 15 years. I was the convener for a privatised section of a city council for 5 years. So I'm very interested in union activities. I'm also very interested in public speaking, and I teach public speaking.
Okay, excellent. And next down the line is Caroline.
Hello, Caroline Sinclair. I worked for the UN for many years for UNCTAD, helping countries to develop their trading and exporting base. I'm involved in transition towns. I also teach public speaking, and I run community organizations.
Excellent. Lots of public speakers here tonight. And next is David.
Hi, I'm David Graeber. I'm an anthropologist, and been involved in various groups over the years, the Direct Action Network in New York, groups tied to People's Global Action, a member of the AIWW. So sort of keep my hand in that which is sort of lumped together as the alter globalization movement.
Excellent. And Jody.
Hi there, I'm Jody. I run a project called Ecolab, Ecological Literacy Initiative, which is basically a network for designers and artists engaged with environmental issues. We do a lot of projects. We're doing a teach-in later on this year and in October. And I'm also involved with quite a lot of different activist networks, including Climate Camp. I co-founded Transition Towns Brixton 2 years ago, so I've got a lot going on over there as well. And also I'm doing a PhD in ecological literacy.
Great, a plate full of loads of different stuff.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think we're going to start with kind of a question for the whole panel, which is basically, is what we're seeing now the beginning of the end for global capitalism, or is this just another recession?
I'd like to hope it's the beginning of the end, but that means people making the effort to understand what's going on and realise that the system has taken away from them the connection between real value and monetary worth. And we need to persuade people that they need to invest their time, their lives, their energy and their resources into things that have real worth.
So I see some nodding heads here on the panel. Perhaps you'd like to explain why you agree?
I absolutely hope that this is the end of global capitalism. However, is it just some kind of trick that they've got to make us work harder, to make us compete for the very few jobs that are out there now. I very much doubt that it's the end of global capitalism. I do hope it is, but I don't think so.
Well, I think one of the fascinating things we've learned from this crisis is that even capitalists don't really have a particular loyalty to capitalism. I mean, they don't care. I think, actually, maybe the problem is misframed. I think maybe the end of capitalism, I mean, all things come to an end, all systems end. It seems every reason to assume that a system based on infinite growth is not going to go on that much longer, just ecologically. In a way, what I'm really worried about is what comes next. I mean, 50 years from now, we're going to be living under something other than capitalism, and I'm kind of worried it'll be even worse. I think it's this is the most important time to start trying to imagine what actually would be better. Because we're going to end up with something else.
The only living thing that can profit from infinite growth is a cancer cell. Yeah.
And even eventually the host does die, so you know, the success is... but in terms of... why is it so important to imagine an alternative? Why would you say that that's an important endeavor in
30% of the jobs in Western economies and probably 75% of the jobs that have gone and will go in this current crisis are invisible jobs. They're tertiary sector jobs. They're not creating anything real. It's all banking, investment, estate agents, selling ideas which can disappear, just like the securities of which Nicholas was talking earlier. We need people to realize that they can have things, they can make things, they can grow things which have a real tangible value. And that's where they should be concentrating their efforts, because then you have slow, developed, sustained growth and something to see at the end of it, rather than invisible figures lost in a computer somewhere.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. And Jody, you were nodding your head along there. Perhaps you have something to add.
I think that's the point is that there's some jobs that need to go. There's a lot of jobs that we don't really need doing, and in order to have the sort of change that we need, where there's going to have to be quite a massive amount of reskilling and new jobs created. And so sometimes you need something to die before something else can actually replace it. There's quite a good term in ecology called catagenous. It means the death in the forest, for example, before a new forest can grow. And so that this is the sort, you know, I don't think it, I don't know whether it's definitely the death of something. I don't know global capitalism. I wouldn't necessarily frame it like that. But that you can't go on getting richer when you're impoverishing the world around you. So it's definitely the end of quite a lot of things, I think.
How would you kind of react from a trade union perspective to people saying that, you know, people's jobs have to die? And I mean, if you take the example of the coal industry, I mean, that means entire communities have to die. How do you resolve that sort of a conflict of interest?
From a personal point of view, there's a lot of jobs out there that are absolutely dehumanizing, okay? The coal industry being one of them. Being underground for 8 hours a day is not a lot of fun. There's, for instance, materials recycling facilities, MRF, a MRF, okay? It's where you, when you put your nice little recycling things into a mixed recycling bag, it goes to a MRF, and people have to sort that out. It is an absolutely horrible job. Okay, there's a lot of jobs out there that just aren't worth doing. So that's from a personal point of view. There's a lot of jobs that just aren't worth doing.
Yeah. Although, I mean, society will always have, or groups of people will always have those jobs that aren't worth doing. And how would you address that issue? And it's a legitimate problem, I guess.
It's a legitimate problem. However, things can be organised better than they are, and jobs can be made better than they are. And really, I mean, taking the MRF example, rather, basically, sort it out, people. Put the paper in the paper, the glass in the glass. You can recycle without having to put everything all mixed together. That's, people are lazy. That's what it comes down to in that case. People can do a lot of things themselves. And there are just a lot of jobs. We have relied for years and years on the plastic fantastic. So much of this economy was based on credit, okay? And people were, restaurants were full, bars were full every single night of the week. And so you're relying on the underclass to keep this going. Now it's time for everybody to get together and start to do things for themselves.
You can stop the problem by stopping it existing rather than solving it after it has come into play. You don't need to collect mixed recycling in the first place. You don't need so much packaging. You don't need to consume vast quantities of very short-lived goods with built-in...
Obsolescence.
Thank you.
I actually heard estimates somewhere that 15 to 20% of the work that's done in our society is actually work that is only made necessary by the fact that people work too much.
Iatrogenic.
Yeah. Basically, you know, all-night pizza delivery men and dog washers and things like that. And if people worked less, there would actually be less need for those jobs. They'd have more time to do things for themselves, which I think is actually very important, because when people talk about the problem of growth, and the need to give up on the idea that the success of a society is how much you grew every year, how many more things you produced than you did last year. Well, people say, well, people will want more and more things. It's human nature. But you know, people also want more and more time. I really like the old IWW slogan from back in the 20s of 4-day week, 4-hour day. you know, we could go to that. And if we just sort of went back to a reasonable pace of work, there would actually be less need for the products, and people would have more time to do things that they truly valued.
Yeah, well, although that's an interesting thing to bring up in the current climate, when a lot of people are going to be made unemployed, and in a way they're not really looking forward to that unemployment, and the fact that they're not going to be having that income stream coming in to support all their expenditures. Like, maybe you can speculate about what you think will...
Dave makes a very good point about the four-day week. We should spread the jobs around. People shouldn't be working a 48-hour week, some of them, and the rest of them not working at all. And most people don't need the amount of money that they can earn in this society working a 48-hour week, even if they're on a very low wage. Mm-hmm. What they need is to change their mindset and think, right, I can be happy without a designer handbag, without strawberries in December that have been flown over from the Cayman Islands, or whatever it may happen to be.
And most of these sort of toys are compensatory for people who don't have time to do things they would really enjoy, like having a proper social life, friends.
Although, what kind of mechanisms would be out there in order to regulate all of this? I mean, I guess one of my issues is that I can't envision like the massive operation that would have to happen for this work to be diffused through this entire network and for everyone to be happy about what they're doing. And I mean, it's just all I see is just the massive machine taking over and telling us what to do. I guess I just have a problem envisioning all these utopic ideals in an actuality.
But we're already ruled by a massive machine. There's already these massive systems that have got us all running this rat race where we don't have enough time to do anything properly. There's already all these systems in place. I mean, most people aren't working for the extra handbag. They're working to pay the rent, because we have a system of where housing is just so incredibly expensive, and that serves the interest of a very small number of people. and so, and yeah, and every, you know, it keeps people, you know, having to work hard, but a lot.
But this is where community organisations can work. Transition Towns, which you know more, you've been working with for longer than I have, can be incredibly useful in this. I'm now trying to set up allotments in some unused green land on my council estate, which will enable people to get fresh organic vegetables at a very low monetary price. They need to put some effort in, but they need less money.
Certainly, I mean, Transition Towns is the main thing it has going for it is it has this vision of where we're going, even while it looks very squarely in the face of the environmental crisis, and they're not shying away from any of the facts, but they say that despite that, we could actually create something positive, something better than we've got today. But at the moment, we've still got all the obstacles of where we're living, and I have to say that the biggest obstacle we have in Transition Towns Brixton is just finding the time and the space. It costs money to meet anywhere. People are so busy that most people don't have the time to devote to growing their own vegetables. And so maybe an economic collapse will at least give people a bit of space to do something.
Space to garden and grow their own potatoes. Well, on that note, we're going to go into a track and take a little break, and we'll be right back. Any second now.
Okay, I dedicate this one to Lorraine and Matty and Bevan and a local crew here squatting this building. This land is our land, squatters' rights. Get up off your knees and fight. That's what has arrived. Get up, stand up. Get up all your ways. Get up, stand up. Now's the time to fly. Get up, wake up. Share a common cry. We're back against the system. Fight the squad's rise. Squatters!
So that was Interterrestrials with Squatters' Rights. Big shout out to the Recknaw crew for recording that for us.
Sweet. So we're back with the panel. Hello. Yes. And so I think we're going to maybe try and talk a little bit more practically now in terms of some alternative economic organizations and models that you've participated in or have read about or whatever. So maybe, Caroline, you can talk to us about the LETS scheme you were talking about.
Well, LETS, Local Exchange Trading Systems, is one of the schemes that's open to everyone. In England, unfortunately, LETS haven't taken off the way they have in large areas of the continent, where there are towns you can go into a shop, buy a bag of millet or have a cup of coffee and pay for it purely in an imaginary currency that is worked out for that area between people in that area. We do actually have one of the world's top experts in LETS sitting in the audience. So she can look at me sternly if I make a mistake. LETS means that local people get together, they work out what they are able to offer and what they would like in exchange. So instead of using money as the basis of the transaction, you use an invented currency which is purely local, and it doesn't have to go through any intermediary stages. Mm-hmm. You need someone to paint your front door. Mm-hmm. I want to learn Spanish. My friend over there wants an apricot crumble. Now, if every one of us can provide a service, but there's also a service that we need but can't do for ourselves, that we can have an exchange between us, and it can be a multi-way exchange, mm-hmm. so that everyone has what they need and only gives what they are able to give. And there is no rake-off by the taxman or the employer or the contractor or whatever. Mm-hmm. It works very well when you have groups of people who, A, are quite committed to the system, B, are prepared to spend as well as generate lets, and you also have a wide range of people. Mm-hmm. What tends to happen in real life is you have some people who have very highly valued skills, which are very hard to get without paying a lot of physical, actual money for, so they get overwhelmed with requests. Please come and mend my computer, build my website, give me an aromatherapy massage, rewire my house, be my plumber, whatever. And all they can find in exchange is lots and lots of people offering babysitting or washing or vacuuming their hallway. Mm-hmm. Let's is brilliant if a whole community gets involved, and it also builds community cohesion. People get to know each other, people learn to trust each other, and people learn to value each other for the skills that every single one of us has.
Mm-hmm. Jody, you were saying that in the transition town, Brixton, you're thinking about currency. It sounds like currency is an issue.
Currency is one of the things that the transition town movement has looked into. Two other transition towns, Lewis and Totnes, have both started their own currency. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that the movement's looking at relocalization and building up resilience in a local space. And so the currencies function, what's happened in both of those towns is that they've made their own currencies, and these currencies have functioned to keep the money circulating within the local space. And that's one benefit. And then the other benefit is just that you have this alternative money supply. So if money dries up, like it is now, for some people, then you could still have trading happening on a local level without, unemployed people could trade their skills without having to get the money from the, mm-hmm. From the banks or from the employer. You could still manage to do things. Is the money system working for us? And if it's not, then can we make our own little money system locally
obviously.
And so we're doing that, actually. We've announced in the last couple of weeks that it's going to happen in Brixton in September.
Interesting. We'll see how that goes.
I'm involved in any experiments right now, but speaking as an anthropologist, I think one of the things that to bear in mind, I'm actually still somewhat enamored with the notion of basic income. I don't know if it has to be based on a state or not. One thing I've observed is that in most functioning societies, I don't think this is a particular functional one right now, certain things are guaranteed. And there's a certain sort of baseline security, which is the very definition of community, which has sort of been appropriated by states, who then withdrew from it and left everyone adrift. So I think that alternative currencies are great. I like this idea, but I also think that if you ever get to the point where whatever your currency system is, you're using the same thing to get bread and milk as you get to get jewelry, it's a problem. I mean, if anything, there should be different systems, and I think we should play around with thinking about different types of value, different spheres, and how they're organized. Certain things should be just everyone automatically gets, and then you build from there.
It stratifies things that people need, and who would be the people that decide those things. I just wonder how that would work cooperatively.
Well, I mean, that's the basis of moral community. I mean, there are certain things that everybody decides that they don't want anyone not to have. But then, if you have a functioning community, I mean, in a way, what's artificial is to have a place where you can have a lot of food and someone next to you is hungry and you don't give it to them. In fact, it creates enormous social mechanisms just to be able to let that happen. It wouldn't happen if you let things out of their own accord.
That makes a lot of sense when it comes down to food. Yeah. But I, for example, need broadband. I'm quite happy to live without shoes.
Then, I feel that way too, actually. Socks, I don't know.
There are other people who will feel exactly the opposite. I don't think we can make rules as to what are the basics and what aren't, because my basic may be your luxury and vice versa.
What do you have to say to that?
They can't hear the nods out there in radio.
They can't hear the nods. However, I just simply believe that historically people have, in times of trouble, people have gotten together, going back to the English Revolution, the diggers, the levellers got together and helped each other. During the 1930s depression, all around the world, people got together and helped each other. And that is what is beginning to happen now. That is what the Let's scheme is about. Basically, it's about people getting together and helping each other. This costs around £1 in a shop.
This is a can of beer.
It costs £3.50 for a pint in a pub. The actual ingredients cost around 4 pence. Okay? People can get together. People can do things to help each other. It's not that hard to make, and you can make it better than this, people.
And that is the whole point about Let. The first letter, the first word, is local. Mm-hmm. The cost of that can of beer is the cost of transporting all the various bits of it all around the world and then joining them up again inside the factory to make a can of beer and to bring it into this physical place.
Well, that's also my response to the point about broadband, because all communities will not decide to do things the same way, and nobody's obliged to live in a community they don't want to live in.
Unfortunately, that's not true. People are obliged to live in communities. Those of us who don't have the resources to go out and buy a piece of land and build ourselves a house.
We're talking about utopia here. We're not talking about utopia.
We can build utopia.
You can build utopia. I live in London.
So, Bill, I mean, what you were describing there with the kind of ebb and flow of kind of communitarianism in society and the various kind of interventions of the state in that, I mean, I guess the most recent kind of withdrawal of the state started in the 1970s with the oil crash, where the kind of post-war pact between unions and governments and employers kind of broke apart. And since then, we've seen the neoliberal era dawn. How do we kind of secure any benefits that we might get from kind of being withdrawn from us? How do we hold on to anything that we gain during this kind of downturn and during this upsurge of kind of community action?
Because unemployment will increase drastically over the next few years. There is absolutely no doubt about that. Unemployment will increase. You're going to see around about 20-30% unemployment very, very shortly. Now, with that many people idle, that many people can get together and start helping each other. That's what it's going to come down to. People, it's about helping each other.
Mm-hmm. But once all them people, you know, get jobs again, how do you hold on to that?
If that ever happens.
I don't think it's going to happen. I don't think consumerism is going to build up again to the point that it has, that the service economy is going to be able to reinflate its financial bubble in quite the way that it has, because people's attitudes are changing. People are becoming aware of the real costs of what they do and what they buy. That there is an enormous cost, both socially, environmentally, in terms of destruction of irreplaceable resources, in some of the items that they've taken for granted, or the flights and the holidays and the luxuries that they've taken to granted. And if we can build that awareness into the hopefully growth rather than reflation of the economy, we can build in the carbon tax, we can build in the idea that the polluter pays, then people are never going to be employed in purely speculative non-jobs again to the extent in which they were last year.
I'd like to
support
what she said, but from a different perspective. Is yes, I mean, there's this growing awareness, but there's also amongst the people, but there's also the sort of physical constraints and the ecological constraints, and the powers that be are quite quickly sort of coming to terms with that, although they've been told for decades. Suddenly they've had this complete sort of shock. And for example, I was invited to a conference at the Energy Institute, and the International Energy Agency had just released a paper. So this is the engineers all over the country there. And basically, the International Energy Agency has just done a complete 360-degree turn, and within the last year announced that peak oil is happening within the next 5 years. And 3 years ago, they were saying that that was a conspiracy theory, that was some sort of, that they were quacks, all this sort of stuff. And now this is something that they're actually saying is happening. And so this is going to fundamentally change the way that policy is created, the way that all of our infrastructure is based on cheap oil. And as
the
government sort of begins to re-examine everything according to this new evidence that the International Energy Agency has suddenly just presented, they're shocked and they're scared, actually.
You don't even need to posit any moral value on behalf of the big corporations. If you hit them in the pocketbook, they will be aware. You tell them, right, you are responsible for the packaging in which your products are sold. It is in their interest in every single way to cut down on that packaging. You tell them the polluter pays, and you make them pay, and suddenly they find ways of cutting the pollution.
Well, very interesting, but we're going to cut to your track for a quick break. After that, we are going to be taking questions from the audience, so prepare yourselves.
Get your thinking caps on.
Okay, I dedicate this one to Lorraine and Matty and Bevan and a local crew here squatting this building. This land is our...
The world, 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 Thank you. We're bogus guests, man. Cheers.
So, Bogus Gas Man, Duck Butter, Fuck You, San Diego. Not quite sure what the name of the album, the band, or the song is, but there you go. I think that's compliments of Rechno as well. So, lo and behold, we actually do have some questions from the audience. We don't have to go to the random question box just yet.
Keep that in store for later.
Yeah.
So, first question from this young man. Thank you for a lovely discussion so far. My question is, well, it's quite a long-winded one, unfortunately, but I've got a lot of time for the barter stuff that you're talking about and localised solutions to a national crisis, but I feel the problem is the greatest disparities that exist amongst humans as a species are global, and as I'm sure the lady speaking from the UN is all too aware of, I think that, you know, we need global structures to deal with, you know, what is essentially a global problem, and a problem which is definitely going to get worse as climate change takes hold and, you know, parts of the world become uninhabitable and stuff like that. The problem's going to become even bigger. So how does that reconcile with the autonomous vision, basically, is my question.
We need to think global and act local, but all over the world. An awful lot of the problems in some of the developing countries in which I've worked, Egypt, the Philippines, Peru, are based on ideas imposed on them by the World Bank and others that their route to development has to be the same or very similar to ours. I worked with an organization in Fiji. They were desperate to try and cultivate more fields. And they were told the only way they could do this was by being sent tractors. I think they were Massey Ferguson's. Brilliant for the constructive economies in the West. They get the tractors out there. They can't get the parts. They can't get the diesel. They sent a lot of people out there to train these Fijian farmers, most of whom had never ridden anything bigger than a moped. And at the end of 6 weeks training on how to drive tractors on the side of a volcano, three of them tried to drive their tractors, this is a true story, tried to drive their tractors straight up the side of the volcano, macho, let's see who can go higher, you're talking about a 45 degree slope, they all fell down, all three tractors were ruined and one of the guys was killed. Think, act local works on every level. It means that we must make people aware of the possibilities of finding their own solutions, help them, once they have worked out what the solution is, to use the solution that they need, not the one which helps our so-called economies.
But how about solutions that are developed locally and don't really cooperate globally? I mean, what do you do in those circumstances? Because we shouldn't be... The point is, at least from my perspective, we shouldn't be telling people what to do. And yet, how do you deal with issues that are global? I mean, does
I'm sorry, Leila, I think we should tell people what to do. I am quite happy to say to you, I will not give you... I will not give you baby milk for your sixth child who is likely to die because you don't have the water to make safe baby milk. But I will encourage you in a breastfeeding program. I am quite happy to say I will provide you with contraception as long as you get your children immunized. I'm quite happy to say I will build you schools as long as you allow your daughters to go to them as well as your sons.
I am a great leading liberal.
Okay. Well, I think we should. There's lots of questions on the floor, so I think we should go back to them. Leave that discussion for another day. Maybe a whole another show.
Yeah, that's awesome.
My prepared question was quite similar. Just looking at how we've been discussing these future possibilities and creating structures to counter a crumbling one around us, whatever, but we're not talking about the fractures that exist within society, whether this is, you know, Western or Third World or, you know, or within London, you know, we've got massively different social environments and material environments. So how are we dealing with crossing these divides, and how does this relate to all the things we've been talking about, I suppose?
We listen to each other. It all comes down to communication.
Okay. Anyone else?
Totally agree. These divisions will decrease over time. Once unemployment increases, which it will do, these divisions shall decrease. Okay? So then there will be much less division. Yes, there will still be division, but we've got to basically, yes, listen to each other, talk to each other, and actually do things, i.e. make beer.
I don't think I necessarily agree with that. I mean, it's nice. I like it. Well, if unemployment made people listen to each other more, then I that would be fantastic. But it also does things like the last time there was mass unemployment in the Depression, it also made fascism. Mm. And Adolf Hitler came out of that. And that is definitely a possibility this time around as well. And I don't think we should take it as a given that the social unrest that will happen in this recession, depression, will it could make something better, but it could also make something much worse.
It's interesting if you look at the history of catastrophes and catastrophic situations, because very often the first reaction is that it brings people together. Everybody starts improvising. There are these kind of rough and ready forms of communism even that sort of emerge because it turns out that that's usually the most effective way to do things. But over time, it can go either way. And I think that there will be lots and lots of improvisation and wonderful things emerge in the wake of an immediate economic catastrophe, oddly enough. But whether that is preserved or whether that it turns massively towards authoritarianism, that's for us. That's what the struggle is going to be all about.
Yeah.
And we have another question here.
Hello, I'm Mary Fee. I've been looking after Let's Link since the year 2000. Since this recession hit us, the inquiries about Let's have increased about tenfold. We've got little forms on our website. You just Google Let's and you get the Let's Link UK website. Look on the map. See if there's a local scheme. If there isn't, fill in the form at the bottom of the page. Those inquiries have been coming in, and people are saying, I'm unemployed, or I'm a housewife, or I'm retired. I've got time on my hands. I'm willing to do something for the community. The goodwill is there. People have got time. About 10% of the people are saying, if there isn't a scheme, tell me how to set one up. And what we're doing now is we're putting it online. Now, by some miracle, there are quite a lot of Let schemes that have been going for 15 or 20 years. They're still out there. People are still doing it by a manual method. And it's a miracle, you know, that they're still there, because, I mean, that is a lot of hard work when you get 100 members. Now, what Caroline was saying is everybody's looking for a plumber. You know, when you've only got 100 members in a scheme, you don't have a well-balanced set of skills. When you can handle numbers, and when you know, if one database fills up, we can clone them off or bud them off and separate the Let's schemes. This weekend we are putting online North London Let's. They've been talking about it for about 5 years. They agreed it last year. It's their AGM tomorrow, and suddenly they will be able to see exactly who's online, what their balances are, what they've got to offer. They'll be able to manage their own accounts, and all the organisers will need to do is to appoint enough local people to manage it while it expands. And it's quite hard for people who set these things up before the internet, who are, you know, 60-something, to actually face up to going online. It's quite hard, and we're working with existing groups. But the new people who are inquiring, they're saying, why isn't it online? So, you know, there's a whole process of transformation there of this model is now changing into something else. It's not like Facebook. It's much more pedantic than that, I can tell you. But it's online, and it's happening. And I just want to ask Jodie, I don't think you had the much conviction when you were explaining about this these Brixton pounds, I went to Totnes and I couldn't find a Totnes pound in Arcturus Bookshop. Pounds have to be bought with sterling currency. So in my book, they're not alternative at all. It's just window dressing. And I'd like you to comment on that.
Tight question at the end.
I'll leave it at that. We can move on to another question. Hello.
I just wanted to say that one of the risks that has been outlined in this phase of crisis is nationalism, but I would, I mean, raise the attention on another risk that we as a movement can face, and is localism, parochialism, campanilism. I mean, most of us, I mean, I think transition towns and other models of local development are interesting ones, but most of us is not living in towns, guys, is living in cities where people live in a place, work in another one, consume in another one. So I think we have to be very careful not to be naive in sort of imagining a feudal situation going back, but really take the challenge seriously of imagining something that is able to deal with a society which is a fluid society, which is about flows, where people live in very different localities, not just one. And I don't want to change the Brixton pound into the Peckham pound, into the New Cross pound any time that I have to go around. And if I'm on the underground, I have to change the underground pound. Or
so, so how do we deal with the schism?
Any responses to that?
Ideally, we're moving back towards the Guy's utopia, which I try to be as anti-utopian as possible. We have levels, we have oversystems, catch nets, infrastructures, and then within that we have local groups, communities in which everyone knows each other, everyone works together, that are small enough to know everyone around you. How we do it practically, let's have your ideas. Yeah. All we need is enough people putting their brains and their efforts.
Okay, cool. We've got a couple of questions coming in now, so another one here.
Hi, yeah. What's the cause of all this? a promise of a quick buck, you know, like a get-rich-quick thing. Everyone wants to, or a lot of people think, yeah, they're sold on a promise of we can make loads of money somewhere. And that's all the all those shares, you know, being bought and sort of, you know, all that really complicated stuff. Is that what has caused it, you know, just everyone wanting to be rich?
Basically, yes. Yes. In a word, everybody did want to be rich for a very long time, okay, and everybody was rich. Anybody could buy a house, anybody could go out, anybody could go on holiday for, you know, go to Australia. There was an ad on TV, it was for the Virgin card, that said, you deserve it. Whatever you want, go to Australia. If you want, and this is what it said, if you want a llama, okay, you deserve it. So just go and get a llama. And that was an ad on TV. Okay, so everybody was rich for a very long time, and it has come to an end.
Well, everybody in this country, perhaps.
Yeah, I was about to say.
This country has sort of bought the compliance of the working class by offering, and you know, cheap flights to Spain and a second house in somewhere, wherever, Bulgaria or something, and another trip to Thailand every year. So, you know, but it's certainly not, that's not the case for most people on
it's
the face.
It's not anymore.
Well, it never was the face.
I
think that there's a.
In this country.
Yeah. Well, I think what's important here actually is that there was the image that everyone can be a capitalist, and that people bought into that.
in a way, I mean, there are people who've suggested that what's happening now is similar to what happened in the 70s, which is that a particular idea of everyone can have the good life sort of hit the skids because it reached a point, a kind of crisis of inclusion. Before that, everybody could be included in the welfare state. And of course, everybody can't. Everybody can't be a rich wage laborer or even a secure wage laborer. Capitalism doesn't work that way. So as soon as it reaches a certain point where everybody wants in on the deal, the whole thing falls over. Here, it was this, since the 70s, there was an oil shock, there was a general crisis and financial crisis and so on. They changed the rules, and this time around the rules were like, well, okay, you can't have job security, you can't have social security anymore, but you can all have a piece of capitalism. Everybody can be a capitalist. Everybody can have stocks. Everybody can have a mortgage and trade off it. People would have microcredit. Everybody can have something. And again, you know, they reached the point where that was just impossible because, of course, everybody can't be a capitalist. That's not how capitalism works. And, you know, we hit the wall and the same thing happened. You have the oil shock, you have the ecological shock, you have the financial crisis. And the question is, what are they going to try now? Because that trick doesn't work anymore. Nobody believes that anymore. And that's the thing which provides a huge opportunity for us, I think.
Okay. Got another question here.
It's actually more of a comment. I can't help drawing parallels to Argentina 2001. And I think not enough people are doing that because there's a lot that we can learn from them. There was a massive social movement that emerged from it. Masses of people did get together. There was 20% to 30% unemployment. But hey-ho, 7 years later, what do we have? The movements are back working. People need to earn money to get, you know, on the one hand, what can we learn from them? So if there is answers provided, what happens? On the other hand, are we going to get to that stage where everyone comes out? I don't know. There's lots of questions. There's lots of lessons to be learned. And I just wonder what you guys have to say about that.
I'll take that. I mean, I think that that might be the case if this was just a cyclical recession caused by, like, some cyclical thing that happened within capitalism. But it seems to me that it's more profound than that because we're actually hitting limits of the system's capacity to support us, considering that we live, you know, every year we consume 30% more of the Earth's biocapacity than, you know, it doesn't have the capacity to regenerate itself enough. And so what's happening is that we're starting to feel that, you know, before the banking crisis was an element of what's happening and, you know, really kicked it, set it off. But there were other things happening last year as well, like all the commodities were going up, food prices were going up, oil prices were going up. And oil prices were going up probably because people were realizing that we were going to hit peak oil in the next 5 years. Food prices were going up because they're cutting down rainforests and making it into agrofuel. You know, they're replacing agricultural land with biofuel, and a lot of other reasons. And just because we have the capacity of the system to feed everybody is decreasing. And so these are real biological factors that are affecting.
We must always remember that we can build an economy from an ecology, but we can never recreate an ecology from an economy.
Okay. Think about Argentina, which is interesting too. You know, Argentina, at the time, people thought it was part of a wave that was going to cause a global crisis such as happened now. They thought after Argentina's Brazil, after Brazil goes the U.S., poof, there goes the world system. They managed to stop it for the last 20 years, there have been endless crisis interventions. And the degree of the global elites to panic has always confused me, because I was always like, do they know something I don't know? They seem like they think the whole thing's going to blow. And it took a while to happen. But in Argentina, a lot of the things started happening very quickly that we might well be seeing on a global scale, including alternative currency systems. I think that's really interesting to look at. They was one of the things they did. In the wake of the disaster, people simply spontaneously began developing these things. In that case, people sabotaged it. It seems like the government came and just started printing these things to subvert the system. And I think that's also something we should look out for, that people aren't going to let us do this lying down. I mean, there's going to be opposition.
Mm-hmm. I just want to finish with one last question from the box, which is, will I still be able to get the doll? No. Okay.
Everybody gets the doll.
Everyone gets the doll. Okay.
You start from the doll and then you go off and want.
All right. Well, I'm afraid we're out of time.
We're going to end the show with an interview with Simon from the Escanda Collective. You can check out the website at www.escanda.org. They did an alternative economic conference back in November 2008 and subsequently created their own autonomous marketplace. So it was interesting kind of talking to him about that. And after that, we'll hear some credit crunch and drum and bass from DJ Dirt from uncut.fm fame.
We'd like to say a big thank you to all our guests and to everyone in the studio.
There's our canned laughter.
Yeah. And thanks for everyone at home for tuning in or downloading it later on. So take it away with Simon.
In this interview, I talked to Simon from Escanda, which translates from Spanish to the Collective Social Space for Self-Management, Diversity, and Autonomy. This is an autonomous collective based in the north of Spain, set up 5 years ago with the purpose of creating space for anti-capitalist critical activists to meet up, share skills. This space holds large-scale meetings and events and serves as a hands-on example to the DIY ethos. Today, different projects include a well-established permaculture garden, building and restoration projects, and politically focused projects including renewables, for example DIY windmills, and large popular education programs with outreach to local schools. Escanda has connections with the local community and also connects internationally, drawing visitors from all over the world. Last November 2008, Escanda hosted an event entitled Life Despite Capitalism, Building Radical Economies. I asked Simon to talk about the process of putting together the conference and what took place.
We felt, of all of our networks of anti-capitalism and political activism, there was a lack of basic understanding about capitalism and its current phase and the economic principles and inner mechanisms which affect all of our lives. And, you know, this came to be true as well when with the credit crunch. You know, I mean, who knew about subprime mortgages beforehand? Or about the derivatives market. We started planning this a year ago, and at first we weren't sure if there was going to be much interest. I mean, you know, economics can be a relatively dry subject, but we really felt, you know, it's at the heart of everything. Of course it is, so it's something we needed to tackle. And then it all kicked off with the credit crunch, and we had a lot more interest, but we also felt there was another side that we wanted to promote, and we wanted to talk about, and we wanted to develop. And that's kind of, you know, the other side to economics, the real economy, which is beyond all these derivative markets and beyond the interbank lending rates. The classic definition of an economy is the production, distribution and consumption of goods and services. There's people that have been working on all sides of this equation all over the world. It's not a new thing either. It's been going on forever. And we want to look at these different alternatives out there, both historical and the contemporary. And learn from them and be inspired by them and see what we can do ourselves now. That was the reasoning behind it. We put the call out, and in the end we had about 100 people coming, which was great. And we had people coming from Spain and from Europe and from further afield as well. It was 3 days long. The first day we wanted to look at the core of capitalism as it is at the moment, some of the theory behind it, how it functions, some of the inherent problems with it. So we were looking at things like credit pyramids and how the, you know, people's reliance on credit means the bank's reliance, means companies' reliance on credit, means government's reliance on credit, means reliance on the European Bank for credit, for example. So we were looking at these various credit pyramids. We're looking at some of the reasons behind the credit crunch. And then we were looking at some of the other sort of moves forward into things like green capitalism, and that they might present their own problems because it's basically a market solution to a problem caused by the market in the first place. So that was day one. Day two was more focused on the practical side of things, on the alternatives out there, on what we can do, what already exists. Could be anything from collectives during the Spanish Revolution to participatory economic networks that exist in Canada and America, to the LET scheme, which, you know, they've set up alternative currencies, which have had, you know, a fair amount of success. At least they have a lot of people involved in the schemes. Day three was an open space day, where, as you can imagine, there was a lot of spillover meetings that people wanted to continue. We just wanted to leave a bit of space open to see what happened during the meeting as well. One of the major outcomes from it was this autonomous marketplace. We've even got a name for ourselves now, which is Bramas in Spanish, which basically means branches. It's also a handy acronym which translates roughly as the network of solidarity, mutual support, and autonomy. The idea was that at this seminar we had dozens of people, or dozens of different collectives and groups and organizations from all over Spain and Europe, you know, who are interested in economics, you know, represented at this meeting. So it was a real opportunity to have a sense of community and to all be in the same room, you know, because of the way it works, we're all quite geographically dispersed. So there's a lack of sense of community. And we don't have a marketplace down the road, as you would have traditionally, where everybody goes down to the local villages and meets up. So we wanted to create our own sense of community and our own marketplace, really. There was a few things that came up during the meeting, and we realised that it's not just a matter of growing a few onions, whacking them in the back of a car and taking them to somebody who's a, you know, more or less conscious consumer. I mean, there's one level of cooperatives there, but the economy is much bigger than that as well. And we wanted to go beyond just the production of goods and their consumption, but we wanted to talk about doing our own distribution. We wanted to talk about things like services as well, and we wanted to share our skills. And rather than selling our labour, we want to be giving our labour to mutual friends in support that way. It's about putting as many things as we can back in what you could call the commons, which is, as you know, you have freeware that's put in commons. We wanted to put these things that should belong to everybody, can belong to everybody, we want to put them back in common. So it means swapping, sharing, exchanging, and things, maybe things have a value, or maybe we can just put them forward. The Scanda, for instance, we've got our own apple orchards. So every year we produce an absolute load of cider, 1,000 litres last year, which it was a bumper crop. So we've got this thing we can share with people and we can swap. And since then, the idea has really taken off. So in 3 months since November, we've had 4 collective work days. It's crazy. I mean, in Spanish, there's a word for it, cesta ferias. We don't even have a word for that. That's our non-existent. The idea is in England. So we've been organising these cesta ferias. The last one was organised in a collective in a city near us, and they've got a huge 1,000 square foot warehouse. And in a weekend between 20, 25 of us, we managed to fit the whole place out with double glazing windows, all of which was recycled, and all of the wood that we used to make the frames was recycled. So, you know, this was a way of pulling ourselves out of the economy and doing what probably amounted to a €40,000 job, but for nothing. Whoa. This certainly happens on a huge level during the Spanish Revolution, for example, when you had tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people represented. On the theoretical level, different people are coming from different positions, and there was no way we could organise this, you know, with one sort of de facto position on it. And one thing we wanted to do was, rather than sit in a room talking about which position we should go for, we should just start actually doing it and then seeing what happens. 3 months down the line, it's work in progress still. I mean, at one end of the spectrum, you have people coming from, say, this, you know, the idea of LETS, which is the local exchange trading scheme system, which is massive in the US. You know, there's hundreds of thousands of people involved, and they have an alternative currency, which obviously isn't a dollar, it's whatever it is, LETS note. It works really well because there's so many people involved. The plumber does 6 hours of work, then they get credits, and they can spend it elsewhere, and there's no middleman along the way. They have a monetary valuation, which is where many of the critics would point to. And at the other end of the spectrum, you have, you know, this idea of the commons that I mentioned earlier. Freeware software is a perfect example. You know, it's putting commons and everybody's free to take as much as they want. So obviously, it's okay with software because you can duplicate it as many times as you want at virtually no extra cost. But if you start to talk about things like our cider again, then, you know, if we put in, say, our 600 bottles of cider and said, hey, take as much as you want, then possibly it could work, or maybe some greedy bastard would come along and nick it all. You can get down to problems of valuation at this point. You know, maybe we want to receive a certain amount for X bottles of cider. And at the moment, because this network is based around mostly around people who know each other, then we haven't got to worry too much because we know nobody's going to test the system and take a load of our cider. For me, it's one of the most interesting things about that is that we're going to try and see what our emergent position is. If this is ever going to work and it's ever going to be expanded, then we need to try and take into account, you know, these various positions. For a more in-depth answer, maybe we should have a chat in another year and see how it goes in the meantime. Even with what we've managed to achieve, you know, it's fairly low scale. I mean, we're not kidding ourselves. We're not providing much of, you know, our overall consumption through this network. And the same that what we've produced, you know, it's not a huge percentage that goes back into this network. Unfortunately, at this stage, nothing more than what we hope is a decent example. How would it work in an urban setting? I mean, it's true, you know, unless you've got a seriously massive roof garden, you don't have a lot of onions or, you know, or a big orchard to make a load of cider from to swap. One idea, actually, this is more personal interest than anything, but what I would really like to see happening is amongst these sort of, you know, political activist communities is factories set up in an urban setting. If you look at the, you know, this woofing phenomenon, then it's massive. It's massive. You know, you've got hundreds of thousands of people every year who go around the world to work on these organic farms and helping to sustain an alternative. So I really hope the same model can be translated into an urban environment. Why not have a factory that produces, say beer? Why not have a factory that functions a small scale cottage industry run by volunteers in the same way that, you know, woofing farms are run by volunteers, but in an urban setting? That gives you a political ammunition that you can then, in an economic environment, that then you can swap and barter, or, you know, sell to organisations that you know whose principles you believe in. That's one, anyway, very personal idea or example of how it could function in an urban setting. Ooh.
cannot give. Every part of me got my soul confused. You get the best, the best. Got my soul confused.
one does fine. People who are that stupid.
Yeah.
Just be good to me. boom. I like the bass that goes boom.